Melissa in the Morning remembers Bridgeport's L'Ambiance Plaza collapse. WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
On April 23rd, 1987, there was a young man who was on his lunch break and decided to drive a certain way that day. And amazingly enough, ended up being here in studio with us now 35 years later to tell us his story. And that's Tony Tafaro. Tony, thank you very much for being here and for talking to us about your story. And I'm just happy to see your face here. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
So, Tony, take your time, but tell us, you were 18 or 19 years old, you were working, and you went on your lunch break. What happened?
Yeah, just driving by. What made me go that way? I don't know. Just a big boom and turned my head, and there it was. Just smoking, something in me just said I had to do something. Got out and started helping people, screaming and yelling, and there he goes. And it all started, you know, and changed my life.
So you were working at a deli?
Yeah, Sorrento's Importing on Capitol and Main.
Sure.
Everyone knows the old deli there. And those guys are like my family, you know. Like I said, some reason what brought me that way, I don't know.
So you don't usually drive that way?
No, never. So I was just going by the church then, just everything just went blank. And before you know it, I was stuck there. The news cameras and... Before I know it, these people are all trapped.
Mm. So you pulled your car over. You saw the collapse happening. You pulled your car over and you just ran over. You had no experience, though, with rescues or anything like that, right?
Nope. Just people are screaming and yelling. It was like a horror show with the smoke, you know, and... I just reacted and just kept going. Before you know it, you know, and found out what really happened. Before you know it, I was in the middle too far in, and, you know, before the police were there, and they weren't letting anybody else in. And we tried to, there's other people there helping out that I met there, and, you know, but definitely was a life changing experience for me, you know. And I just want to say to all the people, I lost a loved one there. God bless you guys and for being strong all these years, but still no one forgets, you know.
Sure. I mean, I can't imagine being a senior, maybe a year out of high school? I mean, you're so young. You were a kid.
I was boxing here and there and really didn't know what direction. You know, I was a young kid and, you know, I know what I was really... Wasn't a college material type person, you know, and this kind of set my way on life to what I'm doing today, you know.
So what were some of the things you stayed on scene, police, fire, all the responders, they allowed you to stay, and what were you doing?
Yeah, no, a gentleman by the name of Doug Jewett, Mexico Earthquake Rescue Team. He was from Miami-Dade, Florida. He comes here to says Connecticut the next day. I ends up meeting this guy. I was in the middle of the night, and he says, I'd like for you to assist us. Who are you? I says, I'm no one. He says, he swore me in. He gave me the uniform and dominated us. He says, you're going to help us with this little reminder. I said, no. So at that time, I felt like maybe that's something I could do. And help people at the same time. Now there's my calling. So I continue following this guy's lead, and before you know it, they wanted to start a disaster school training, and I did some schooling, and got complicated later on because I did have a back injury from a previous injury, but and again, life changes, so.
But you seem like the kind of guy, Tony, who... When you see trouble, you just jump to it. It almost gravitate to it. It almost seems.
I mean, I guess it's normal for me. All my friends will tell you when they hear this. They say, "Yeah, that's Tony, who's always the one to jump in." And I was the smaller guy, but I was always the guy to help. You know, it was just always me. It was my nature.
Just
you know,
seem
if I
natural.
Had $10, I'll give you $5. Just be my friend. It was just the way my mother's named me Anthony, Saint Anthony after Saint, because I always like to help people, and I'll never change. You know, that's what the Lord wants us to do, God. Help each other out in this world that's turmoil, mm-hmm. you know, political and all this. We're in a mess, guys. Mm. So.
Yeah, it's so true. Tony DeForo is here, and Tony was driving during his lunch break and saw what was unfolding in Bridgeport 35 years ago and just jumped in to help without any training, without any background, just felt compelled to help. And you can see visibly, Tony, that it doesn't matter how much time has gone by, it's still something that really affects you, understandably so. Like, what are you thinking about this morning?
But if it's in a good way, I mm-hmm. think, because it's enabled me to give hope to other people, you know, that everything's, no matter what in life, just keep going forward, no matter what. You know, I lost my brother. I just lost my father a couple of weeks ago.
I'm sorry.
My brother, pancreatic cancer, and my mom. But they're all in a better place. But look at the legacy you want to leave behind. Try to leave something behind that someone could follow that's good in life. You don't need, doesn't need money to do that. You can be a normal person, you know. I'm lately trying to reach out more to kids, trouble kids. Got into the fitness business now, personal training in Florida.
Wow.
Which I think my true calling, because I get along with people, older people, injuries, and I like doing it. I really enjoy it.
That's great.
So there's another change. So keep struggling forward, but, you know, life changes, and you'll never, you know. But again, my heart's out to all the family members of L'Ambiance. You know, I guess we'll never forget.
No.
You know, I'll never forget what I was trying to explain to people, if you can understand this. I remember the faces of the deceased, but it's the names that get confusing to me after years. I can't place the names anymore.
Sure.
You know, and I know they're all in peace, but so much time has gone by.
Mm-hmm. But those faces are like etched in your brain.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I really, and when I hear my friends and the anniversaries come by, I have that 1 or 2 day type of feeling, and then it goes away. Because
yeah.
I try to think of it, I did a wonderful thing. I didn't. Even though there was no one felt alive, it was a wonderful thing that I did. And everybody did, the Coke community. We had a community, Bridgeport, that stood together. That's amazing. And a pancake disaster, that's major.
Mm-hmm.
People, I mean, I studied a little bit after you get involved in something like that. And this is something major. In Bridgeport, Connecticut, we're not equipped for that, people.
Mm-hmm.
And we did wonderful, just to the people, the Red Cross, you know, oh my God, the nurses at night, always asking me, you okay, everybody, you know, oh, from old ladies, from old people, from young to old, the interview, but all my friends, they wanted to help. They were too, they couldn't let anymore in. There's so many people, so thank you for all the community. And like I said, I left Bridgeport, but my heart's always here.
That's so beautiful. Tony, I so appreciate you coming into studio and, like I said, being here with you and talking about this. Is there anything further you want to leave for people today?
No. It's, we'll never forget. It's not to forget, but don't linger on the past and go for the future and look at the legacy that these people left behind in grandkids and grandsons and for your own families and just love every each other and do the best we can.
And, I think that's a beautiful message.
Like I said, anybody needs any training, want to come to Florida, look me up.
I love that. Tony,
thanks
so
for
glad
having
to meet
me.
You.
Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We'll be right back. Thank you so much.
It's Telep.
You were an electrician working on the L'Ambiance Plaza project at the time. What happened that day 35 years ago?
So I'll never forget because we came back after lunch. It was a nice, clear, sunny day. And we had always talked about being nervous about working in there because we said, well, if they're raising these slabs up over our head as we're working underneath them, what's to stop them from coming back down again? So we had already discussed it, that we said if we hear anything out of the ordinary, anything unusual, we're going to run first and ask questions later. And that is actually what saved my life and David Hoyt's life, the apprentice that was working with me at the time. happened to be, fortunately, we were on the, I believe it was the West Tower, if I remember right, but near the edge of the building. We were running 4-inch rigid conduit, and I was holding the 10-foot length, and David was going to spin on or screw on the 90-degree sweep, and I couldn't hold the pipe up high enough for him to do that, so we had to go to the edge of the building so I could hold the pipe lower so he could spin that 90 over the edge of the building. And as we were doing that, all of a sudden there was a rumble, and we knew that was out of the ordinary because it was, like I said, a sunny day with blue skies, but it sounded like thunder. Mm-hmm. So that caught our attention, and we stopped. And then there, the air kind of filled with dust, and it's like, what's going on? And then all of a sudden there was an ear-piercing crack as if a bolt of lightning literally hit like 10 feet away from you. So at that point, both of us looked at each other. Our eyes got, as big as a deer in a headlight. And we dropped the conduit, went right to, David jumped down. I jumped down off the edge of the building behind him. Now, we were on the third floor, but L'Ambiance Plaza was built into the side of a hill. So we are on the hillside. It was about a 5-foot drop down to the ground level. The other side of the third floor, you would have been up about 30 feet off the ground.
Wow.
So we jumped down, and as we were running, fortunately, they had dug a trench coming in from the street for the underground utilities. And as the building was collapsing, we're looking over our shoulders, we're running, and you could see from the top deck down, all of a sudden, boom, 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 as each deck fell and hit the one below it, it broke it loose, and then it would come crashing down. But the blast of air from those decks collapsing was so strong, it was blowing chunks of concrete the size of your fist through the walls of all the trailers that were around the job site, the jobbing trailers and material trailers. But that same blast of air blew us into that trench that had been dug coming in from the street. So it was like being in a foxhole. All the debris went over our head, and that also is kind of what saved us. We got up completely covered with dust. I ran into our trailer that was not too far away with the idea of calling 911 to get help there. And our sub foreman, Don Waleski, was already in the trailer on the phone. And I can still to this day remember him. He's like, send everything you got, fire department, ambulance, everything. He says, the building just collapsed. And so I immediately just unbuckled my tool belt and let it drop to the ground and ran back into the building to start looking for survivors to see if there was anybody we could help get out of there.
You know what's eerie about this story is the fact that you had sort of thoughts in your mind like, man, this would be really scary if this ended up coming down. And how do you think it even, I mean, I guess the fact that you kind of had that eerie feeling in the back of your mind, but your quick action, I mean, literally, I would think seconds later, if you had delayed or if you had, these days people have earbuds in when they're working. I mean, if you didn't even hear those sounds, I don't know if you'd be here, Cliff.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, we did react instantly, and that is what saved our life because we had discussed it beforehand. And that's why even to this day, I still almost think about L'Ambiance on a daily basis because I'm still working in construction. I'm a volunteer electrician at, I don't know if you've ever heard of Jehovah's Witnesses, but
sure.
Their world headquarters is in New York State, and I'm working at their educational center in Paterson, New York. But we're actually in the process right now of building another building. There's 25 buildings here, and so I'm still working as an electrician. So every day on the job, I think about that. I'm always looking for the closest escape route, the quickest way out, just in case something goes wrong. That truly has affected me for the rest of my life since that incident happened.
How old were you?
I just turned 65 yesterday.
Oh, well, that's amazing. Happy birthday. You were young. You were my age. You were really young when this happened. Wow.
I was 30 years old, when it happened. And, the funny thing, too, is I was trying to my dad and my brothers all worked in construction. They were pipe fitters. And I was trying to describe to them this type of construction because it was something new to the area in Connecticut. We'd never experienced it before. So I had taken 3 rolls of film of the job with close-ups and overall views, and that was back when you would send your film in the mail.
Sure.
It literally came back in the mail the day the building collapsed. And it was those photos that I had taken that, of course, OSHA and all the other investigative agencies You know, I gave copies to all of them, and that's partially what proved, you know, how the building collapsed, that it was, you know, a combination of human error, lack of safe following the safety guidelines, because, in fact, to this day, when you Google L'Ambiance Plaza, most of the pictures that you see beforehand were all the pictures that I took. The overall pictures of the building, the close-ups of the welders welding the steel collars to the columns, the, you know, so anyway, that's just by coincidence is what also helped with the investigation.
How do you feel that it's been 35 years already?
Yeah, the time has flown by. It doesn't seem like it's been that long. You know, when you, the other day when we were talking, it's like, wow, 35 years. It's like, oh my goodness, it still seems like it was just last year to me. But again, I think part of that is because, you know, I'm still working in construction as an electrician. And I think about it on a regular basis.
Wow. Cliff, we appreciate you sharing your story. Is there anything else you want to add?
No, I'm just grateful that I was able to make it out. You know, it really is sad how many men died in that collapse, mainly because of human error and lack of following safety guidelines. And I just hope that in the future, people have learned from this and, you know, things like this won't ever happen again. Unfortunately, it seems like they still do. At the time when it happened, I think it was the worst construction disaster in the United States. But since then, it's fallen to like number three, I think, because there have been others that have been worse. And every once in a while, I've still seen on the History Channel or Discovery Channel where they'll have like engineering disasters and they'll have, you know, this experience from L'Ambiance Plaza. And, you know, even when I see those again, you know, just it's like a flashback to the day that I was there and, you know, hearing all the noise and the excitement. I worked on the rescue operation for the next 10 days, mainly doing electrical work, you know, providing temporary power for the tools that were needed to, you know, saw cut the concrete or jackhammer it, lighting at night. You know, we were there around the clock 24/7 for the next 10 days. And then I was actually the only one there after that for the next 3 months. Because so many people had donated things to help with the, you know, this to speed up the recovery. When they found the last body and everyone left, they pretty much just abandoned everything. Mm. So my the contractor I was working for, OJ Mann, left me there to electrically disconnect everything, make sure it was safe, and then try and get a hold of the owners to come pick up, you know, the tools or the lighting or whatever it was that they had donated to the project. So I was there for the next 3 months by myself doing that. And that was kind of eerie, too, because then it was, at that point, all the debris had been hauled out. And it was like just an empty quarry. And walking around the perimeter of that and looking in, you know, I would have dreams and nightmares about it. It was just an eerie sound, especially when the wind would blow. And that was the other thing I remember. When we were working there at night on the rescue operation, apparently I think it was some of the plumbers in the basement. They were working on the boilers. They had had the little portable radios. Well, the radio, you could still hear it playing at night because then, by then it was quiet enough. And to hear that radio playing at night, in fact, I think it was your station, WICC, you know, that was kind of until the batteries finally died on it. But that was an eerie sound, too, just to hear that radio playing at night, you know, knowing that there had been men down in the basement and none of them made it out alive.
Oh, my gosh, I have goosebumps. That's unbelievable. Well, Cliff, wow, that's an unbelievable story, and I'm certainly glad that you got out and that you're okay and that you can share this with us even 35 years later, and I thank you for continuing to work in this industry. Like you said, it certainly is not perfect. It's, I think, in some ways gotten better, but, you know, certainly this feels like it just happened yesterday. So it's I do thank you for the work that you do. And thank you for sharing your story on the show. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for having me. You know, a little bit about my dad. My dad definitely was the main person in all of our lives. My mom, my sister, and myself. And, of course, L'Ambiance took him away from us. And he was a very hardworking man. What I remember most about him was his strength and his courage and his honesty and just the love he had for us girls. And he went to work every day to make sure that we had what we needed, and he did the best he could to provide for us. And, you know, honestly, to this day, given his strength and his character, I was convinced when I heard about LaBianne's falling and even being there on site and watching them, you know, take people out, I was just convinced that somehow he was still made it through that and he was going to be okay just because he was so strong. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case. I have to say that I have a picture. I'm sitting here looking at it, and to this day, it still hurts really bad. And we miss him terribly, and we honor him, you know, obviously on this day, but every day, every holiday, every time we go up to his grave and put new flowers on there, he just really was an amazing man, amazing dad, and really just a great person. And I just, you know, 35 years later, it doesn't hurt any less. I have a daughter now and a husband who never got to meet my father. They see pictures. We have old movies that he used to take. And so at least they know what he looks like. And of course they hear me talk about him all the time, but unfortunately neither my daughter nor my husband got to meet my dad. So he's been gone a long time. Makes me feel really old, but I think I have, you know, his strength in me, and it's going to be a tough day on Friday. It's going to be great to have everybody there in person this time. Many people who are still with us there during, you know, this time. It'd be nice to see the families. We went last year, even when there wasn't a ceremony. And we met a gentleman there who was also in the LaBianne's. He made it out. But I would have to say that he was not very happy about that because he lives with that horror every day. Mm. And we met him, and it was great to meet him. And I hope I get to see him when we're there on Friday. But, you know, I hope on Friday we have a great sunny day to honor all these men who lost their lives unnecessarily. And I really hope that the families have gotten some peace. You know, I know that it's just hard for everyone. And unfortunately, my mom now can't come with us. She's in a nursing home with Alzheimer's, and she's very happy right now because she can't remember what she doesn't have. But I'm sure in her own way, even though she can't show us, that she's missing him just as much as we do. And at some point they'll be together again. And I just have to get myself through this week and through Friday. But I appreciate your time and listening to me. But he's a great man. And I'm sure all the men that died that day were great men. And all the men that helped and all the service people that helped and tried to rescue the people, I'm very grateful for them.
I always appreciate talking to you each and every year, Paula, and I thank you so much for coming on again this year and sharing your dad's legacy. And do you mind me asking how old your daughter is?
My daughter is 17.
Wow. So,
yeah.
Wow, that's unbelievable. So that's incredible. So almost like half the amount of time that has gone by.
Yeah.
She's not known her grandfather. That's unbelievable. How do you think what do you think he would think of like your family, of your daughter, his granddaughter? What do you think he'd think of her?
Oh God, I think he'd love her to death. You know, he was a baseball player. He actually got drafted right out of high school to go to the major leagues. And he was with my mother at that time. They weren't married yet, but they were high school sweethearts, and unfortunately got hurt when he was there during tryouts and stuff, and came back, got married my mom and had me, and then had my sister a few years later. And you know, he's always loved his girls, so I know he would love her to death. She's a singer. She tried sports, she tried softball, you know, for all the reasons, you know, that my dad loved it. But you know, her passion is singing, and she sings, and she just, you know, she acts, she goes to, you know, acts like she's known my dad because there's pictures everywhere. And she, you know, we talk about him, and she goes to the cemetery with me, and she, you know, takes off the old flowers and puts on new flowers. And she's even driven the dog by herself. We have a dog, and she drives the dog down there sometimes by herself and just goes alone. So,
wow.
They have a connection, even though they don't know each other. And so I'm very proud of that. And we keep him alive as much as we can. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sitting here looking at his picture, and it's like he's staring right through me. I know he's here somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a testament to you too. That's a really incredible thing. And a lot of times people will just kind of bury the people who are gone. And I love the fact that you did just the opposite, and that your daughter has such a close connection to your dad. I think that's beautiful and such a testament to you as a mom. So well done. Well done to you.
No, thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
He taught me everything. He taught me how to be a family person, and family always comes first. So that came from him.
Well, Paula, we so appreciate you, and I am praying for you, all the families who are still 35 years later, you know, just wondering, you know, could something have been different that day? And I'm so, so sorry for your loss. I will say that to you every year, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart. And I thank you so much for always coming on the show each and every year. It means a lot to me.
Thank you, Melissa. I appreciate it.
All right, Paula, we appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Go for it.
Hi, my name is Don Emanuel Jr. My father was of the same name, but he was Donald Emanuel Sr. My father was an electrician. In fact, the only electrician that died at L'Ambiance Plaza that day. My dad was only 48 when he died. And I can remember at the time when I turned 48 years old, And thinking, and especially when I turned 49, thinking, wow, my dad never even got to this age, you know. And, you know, when you're younger, you tend to think of ages as older, you know. And then when you get to that age, all of a sudden it's not so old anymore, you know. So I realized just how young he was in later years when he died, and how much of his life was taken away from him. But my dad, like you say, was the only electrician. He was from Local 488. Proud electrician, and he was also the foreman on the project. He was the electrical foreman. The interesting story there is fate. And the fate was my dad, it was a Friday. My father was supposed to leave at noon, and my mom was home, had the car all packed for Maine. And if he had left at noon, he would have been fine because that accident happened at 1:28 p.m., so he was a one more thing, very conscientious kind of guy. And he wanted to take care of one more thing before he left. And he happened to be up in the building when it happened. So anyways, he was the general foreman on the site. He had some sub foremen under him. And you know, generally, you know, he was the type of guy, he was like a mentor to many who worked for him. He was a natural born leader. For sure. He's a very, very likable person as well. The people, you know, remembered him for many reasons. They had respect for him when they worked for him. And also they liked him. So he loved his family and friends a great deal. He was a ball player most all his life, from the younger ages of hardball and school ball, and played for Caner Tech High School and he was one of the first graduating classes. He was the first graduating class that did all 4 years at Caner Tech when the school was brand new. He was the first class to do all 4 years at that school. So anyway, he played ball, and then he played softball later on for local civic clubs. He belonged to, like, the Villanese Club. And basically, we miss him a great deal still to this day. Of course, and he didn't get to see all his great grandchildren. He got to see a few, and I'm sorry, not that his grandchildren. He saw a few of them, but not all of them. So he lost out on a lot, and the family lost a lot when we lost him on that day. So,
Don, how old were you when your dad passed? And were you expected to go to Maine with your parents?
No, my parents were going to Maine to buy a cottage. And there's another quick story I can give you there. They were going to buy a cottage. So they looked at it previously, and they were going up to actually purchase it. And as you might imagine, when they didn't show up, the people are wondering, like, where are these people? They thought, you know, we had an appointment. They were coming. What's going on? And of course, we had other things on our mind besides, you know, canceling appointments. Right. So it took a while for these people to find out what happened. And an amazing little story there is those people saved that cottage for an entire year. They took it off the market. And they literally waited an entire year so that they can contact my mom a year later and ask her if she was still interested in buying it.
Wow.
Knowing that, you know, that she could have very well said no. And they waited a whole year. They owned the thing and held it just to ask my mother if she still wanted it. So we ended up buying it, and we named that cottage Dad's Dream.
That's beautiful. Do you still have it?
We do.
Wow.
Very proudly so.
So how old were you when your dad passed?
I was, I believe, 24.
Wow. That must have been so, that I mean, your 20s are just such a growing time of your life, post-grad and first jobs and starting a family probably very soon after. And it has to be unreal to do it all without your dad.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely is. And you know, everybody's situation is different. And I'm not saying anyone is more important than anyone else, but I did so much with my father. You know, we were hands-on kind of people, and we did electrical jobs and such, and had a lot going on, you know, when he passed. And then when I had to go back and finish some of these projects that we had started, and, you know, and it was difficult. You know, to go back and see things that he worked on and he installed and he labeled and, you know, and I had to finish things up. And it was just hard to pick up and continue afterwards. You know, it took me a while.
Are there ever times where you see your dad or you, like, you feel his presence or you think about him?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. For sure. There's many, many things, you know. His birthday is always one of them, and of course, because, you know, and then I always go visit over at the cemetery, unfortunately. But the other times is things that, you know, monumental things that happen in life, like when my daughter got married and, you know, things of that nature, the, you know, life events that he misses out on. And we still think of him and wish he was there, you know. My mom is an amazing, strong person, and she helped keep things together for, you know, for all of us, you know, and including, you know, ended up purchasing that cottage because she thought my dad would have wanted us to have a place where we can be together, you know.
Is it hard to believe it's been 35 years?
Yeah, it is absolutely very hard to believe because it's literally a blur for me, and, you know, it really, really does change your life when you lose someone that significant at such a young age. It really, you know, it really has an effect on the way your life turns, you know.
Yeah.
So I always think of how different my life would have been if he was still here. So
I would imagine.
My mom is a very, very healthy 83 years old right now.
Wow.
And I don't imagine he would be any different. So.
Wow. Well, we so appreciate you taking the time to share your dad's legacy and to share his story and to give us a few minutes of your time. And I'm still so sorry many years later for yours and your family's loss, but I'm glad you kept that place in Maine. I think that's really amazing.
Yeah, thank you. And it is, and it's very, very special to us. So I appreciate it. And I thank you for, you know, taking the time to talk to the families and, after all these years, you know, it's still very much an effect on the victims' families.
Mm-hmm.
So I appreciate this effort and want to thank you.
Well, it's truly nothing to thank me for. I think the fact that you all have continued. So many of you say the same thing, that you've kept the legacies alive and you shared it with generations that never got to meet, like your dad, for example. But I'm sure all of his grandchildren know about him, know who he is, and that you all keep them so alive year after year. I think it's really amazing. It's a testament to all of you. So I'm just the person with the microphone. You guys are the true incredible people here. So I thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
At the time, it was known as the worst construction tragedy in the United States. And even today, it's still one of the most profound times that construction went through such a horrific tragedy. And I'm talking about the L'Ambiance Plaza collapse in Bridgeport. This Saturday will be 35 years since that happened. And interestingly enough, I got connected to a man who was one of the first people to hear the collapse happening and to go to the scene, because he was a pastor at St. Augustine's Cathedral at the time and was able to walk right there and actually got there before most of the first responders even got there. Joining me this morning, I'm honored to have Monsignor William Scheid here to recall that morning and what followed afterwards. Father, thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm very fine. Thank you for having me.
So take us to that day, if you don't mind, Monsignor. What happened?
Well, it was the week after Easter. I believe it was on a Tuesday. And it was a wet, kind of cloudy spring day. It was early in the afternoon, shortly after lunch. I was in my office, actually, at the time, getting ready to leave for a few days off after Easter. And one of my associates came in and said to me, "Did you hear that noise?" And I had been on the phone at the time, and I did hear a noise, but most of the time you hear a lot of noise there because it's right next to Route 8. I said, "Well, I heard it, but it was probably Route 8. He said, "No, it was just a different sound." He says, "I had a fire scanner on my desk because I had been fire chaplain in Norwalk for a number of years, so I had to change to Bridgeport. We turned on the scanner, and they were just dispatching the Bridgeport Fire Department to a possible building collapse on Washington Avenue." So he and I rushed out the front door of the rectory, and although we couldn't see the site itself, we were able to, before that, see the superstructure of the building, the girders and things as the floors are being raised. As you know, it was a lift slab construction. The 13 slabs had been poured on the ground, and then they were being jacked up floor by floor. Mm-hmm. And before they came down, we could see it from the front door of the rectory. And we saw that the structure was gone, and we both ran down the street. As I said, the fire department was just arriving as we arrived, and we all just stood there. It was just maybe 7-8-story pile of twisted cement and girders, and what do you do? There was just no place to start, no beginning. The fire department didn't have equipment that even today's fire trucks are a little bit built a little bit differently with buckets on them. But in those days, it just had ladders, and there was very little anybody could do until the construction people very graciously arrived and brought all kinds of cranes and things. But of course, at that particular point, there was no sign of life. One victim, a young fellow who had gone to work with his dad that day, was able to be pulled out, but he had already died. Mm. And the rest of the victims were buried in the rubble. And so the 10-day ordeal experience began. It took 10 days to remove all of the rubble because they did so very carefully, especially in the beginning. Hopefully they were going to find some person may have survived. There was one young man, I forget what his name was. He was nicknamed the Mole. He was brave and a very thin person. He was able to wrap his body in and out of some of the little spots that you could get into to see if anybody was there, but no life was found right from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And so it began a search and find situation, but really not a search and rescue because the people had just been buried under that huge amount of debris.
Yeah, that young man, Tony, is actually going to be on our show for the remembrance. And it's unbelievable the work he was doing. He was 18 at the time on his lunch break. Right, and he just pulled over and went over. So that's an incredible story that we'll be sharing. You know, when you see things like this happen, I have to imagine, Father, people start asking the question, where is God in all of this? I would imagine you got asked that question a lot of times.
Yes, you do. And, you know, it's a question that it's ironic that people ask us, but we ask also. You know, sometimes people look at religious leaders as having all the answers, and we don't. A tragedy like that, although it was to be followed by many more, I can only relate when I saw the towers go down, 9/11. Mm-hmm. I saw him on television. I saw the second plane hit, and I saw the two towers collapse. And when you see this, and even right now, what we're seeing, the terrible, terrible destruction in the Ukraine, you have to ask that. But then, you know, on the other hand, God doesn't have us on a string, and he doesn't push buttons for these things to happen or not to happen. Some of them are from human frailty and human designs. The lift slabs, slab construction, for example, should never have had people in the building when the slabs were being raised. But they didn't know it at the time. They didn't know it. It was something that was just taken for granted that the slabs would be fine. And who knew that the jack was going to slip and come down? It's a tragedy. But on the other hand, in the midst of all of that, there was a lot of good that was done. The common cause of trying to help these people and help their families. We housed in Colby Cathedral High School in the gym. Bishop Curtis lived with us at the Cathedral Rectory at the time and came over and told me to use whatever I needed to use that belonged to the church. So I talked to Mayor Busey at the time, and he had Larry Condon was his assistant. He and Superintendent Walsh, who was the superintendent of police, his daughter. The three of us kind of put together a plan for the use of Colby, the gym, where the victims' families moved in, camped out for 10 days. Wow. And the Baptist church down the street opened up its facilities for the workers to be fed and cared for. And it was a very cold, cold time, and word went out that the rescue workers needed warm clothes. Well, the amount of clothing and gloves and sweatshirts and things that were brought down was enormous. Food, when I originally saw it, I thought, how are we going to feed all of these people? And we used to have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich apostolate at the door of the rectory for those who came to us in need. But I know I said to myself, where are we going to get all of the food to feed all these people? Well, the amount of food that was donated in the next 10 days was unbelievable.
I was going to say, sounds like a Bible story, I know. Where are we going to feed all these people?
Yeah,
how are we
really
going to do
really.
It? Oh, that's
well,
amazing.
I'll tell you, the people of Bridgeport, as they often do, responded quite generously, quite generously. Restaurants sent down meals. The families who stayed in the gym were well cared for. The gym was ideal for them because there were showers and bathrooms and everything there. It wasn't the most comfortable place to sleep, but they brought their sleeping bags and they bonded. There was a bonding between the family members and of all of the victims, and they wanted to stay together. A psychiatrist arrived, and he told us we should get them all separated. Put them in different classrooms. Don't have them all together. They wouldn't move out of the gym. They just insisted upon staying together, bonding together, and they did. And as each family dealt with the founding of their lost one, the others just rallied around them and stayed with them. And that continued right until the very last person was found. It was a Friday night when they found the last two victims, and it was about 1:30 in the morning. And there was still a number of people there. In fact, even the bishop himself was there with them that night. And we stood around and we prayed. Every night there was a prayer service in the cathedral. It was Easter time. And because it was Easter time, there was a lot of faith experiences going on through the Easter season. And many of the people were Italian from Waterbury. And in fact, the mayor of Ponte in Italy came over because many of the workers were from his city.
Mm.
And we had a prayer service in the cathedral every evening at 8 o'clock. Everybody would gather, and nobody knew it. The nice part about it, there was no press, no publicity, nobody. Mm-hmm. But about maybe 100 people or more gathered in the cathedral every evening at 8 o'clock for a prayer service and before they went to bed. And it was very beautiful. It was a very beautiful expression of faith. But again, in the midst of it all, yes, there is question why do these things happen? But I guess if you look back at the history of the world, this is the condition of the human race. We have great triumphs and we have great tragedies.
Mm-hmm. So true. It's so true. I have the incredible honor of having Monsignor William Scheid here, who was the pastor of St. Augustine's Cathedral during the time of the L'Ambiance Plaza collapse in Bridgeport. And Father Scheid, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but I was hoping that for those who are hurting with the anniversary looming and this time of year is just really difficult for them. As you mentioned, we're just coming off of Easter, and for many people, there's times of loss, and especially on the heels of this anniversary. I was just wondering if you would do a prayer over the air for anyone who really needs it, whether it's for the anniversary or just feeling a loss right now.
Oh, I'd be happy to do that, Melissa. Let us pray. God, whom we call our Father, we turn to you in times of difficulty and challenge. We ask you to be with us, to strengthen us, to have faith and trust in you, that in spite of our personal losses, in spite of our heartaches at the loss of loved ones, we will hope that one day we will join them in the peace and happiness of your kingdom. Help us to have a heart filled of generosity toward those who are in need, and help us always to remember that we are your holy people, and we are here to make you present by the way we live our lives each day. And we pray now in the name of Jesus the Lord. Amen.
Amen. Father, we thank you so much for sharing that memory from 35 years ago, and I thank you for still serving so many in our community. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Melissa.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye now.